This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at southdakotachannel.org.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the governor's final legislative press conference. My name is Kelsey Pritchard. I'm the communications director in the governor's office. And just a reminder for everyone on the phone, you can mute your lines now by pressing star 6 and unmute during Q&A by pressing pound 6. And a reminder for everyone in the room to use the mics at the table. With that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, those of you in the room, for being here, and those of you on the line for joining us. We're closing in on the end of session. Today represents the final legislative day of this week, and then there are a few more days of action, and the last 3 days of next week are reserved for conference committees and concurrences. So really, there are three more days, including today, to take action on bills within the rules as they're written today. And then, of course, there's one remaining day at the end of the month to consider vetoes. Obviously, the first and foremost thing I'm happy about this session is the passage of House Bill 1182, the increased sales tax that will allow us to fund teacher pay at levels that make us more competitive than we've been. There are a couple of other bills that are part of the education funding package, as you know, House Bill 131 and Senate Bill 131 and Senate Bill 133. Senate Bill 131 was amended day before yesterday, and so it needed to have an intervening day. It will be on the floor today. Senate Bill 133 was unamended 2 days ago, and so it came to the floor yesterday, was deferred to today. So both of those bills are on the calendar for today in the House. I don't know whether they'll take them up or whether they'll defer them until Monday. I think it's very possible they'll defer them until Monday because I expect there'll be a fair amount of conversation about the bills. 131, of course, deals with the pay, the target average teacher pay. It deals with teacher-student ratios, deals with capital outlay, with reserves, many of the fundamental changes to the funding formula beyond teacher pay. 133 deals with the efficiencies we hope to help districts achieve through sharing of services, through e-learning. We also want to help keep those teachers who start out in the field through mentoring, and that's contained within 133. I'm very hopeful that both of those bills will have wide support. I certainly believe they'll have majority support, and I look forward to those bills completing our package of educational proposals this session. Remaining, we have the General Appropriations Bill. That's generally near the end of each session. And we have a number of special appropriations bills that will also be decided upon in the next few days. One bill yesterday came before the House, House Bill 1203, which represents the bill that proposed to spend some of our reserve funds and freeze tuition at our public universities. That passed the House handily with a 60-8 vote. And so I think that's a good indication that there's broad support for that proposal, and I'm hopeful we'll see that same support in the Senate as well. I'm optimistic the appropriations committees will adopt a responsible budget with conservative revenue estimates. We've been doing that for the last several years, since 2011, the year we had to make very difficult expense reductions to bring our budget into structural balance. Many states still do not adopt very conservative revenue estimates, and at this time of year, they are gathered mid-year in their budget cycle to figure out how they're going to make their out-of-balance budget balance. So they're either considering tax increases to cover spending they've already authorized, or they're considering what spending they've authorized they have to cut. And I'm happy South Dakota is not a state like that. We underestimate, conservatively estimate our revenue so that we have a high degree of confidence that the money we appropriate will appear when revenues come and will be there to spend, and that we can have the more pleasant task of deciding how to spend those small amount of dollars that came in above the estimate. Some states, as much as they may try to project with conservative estimates, are frustrated by the economy. And so you look at Oklahoma, look at Alaska, look at North Dakota, they're all having to make substantial cuts to their current year budgets because oil revenues are substantially below where they were projected. Now, I mentioned some of these other states because some commentators will suggest that South Dakota is becoming too easy to spend, too easy to raise taxes. To those people, I would point out that South Dakota and Vermont share the smallest budgets in the nation. Vermont, of course, is a much smaller population state than South Dakota. So per capita, South Dakota has the smallest general fund budget in the nation. Let's compare ourselves to North Dakota. North Dakota has about 100,000 fewer people than South Dakota. They spend $1 billion more than South Dakota. Look at Wyoming. Wyoming has still fewer people than South Dakota, about 250,000 fewer people than South Dakota. Wyoming spends $2 billion more in their general fund budget. Alaska is about comparable to North Dakota, a little smaller population in Alaska than North Dakota. They spend $3 billion more than South Dakota's general fund budget. So to those people that think that South Dakota is somehow losing its grip on its conservative fiscal ways, I suggest you better take a look around, because we're still pretty careful about our dollars, and we don't raise a lot, and we don't spend a lot. So with that, I'll open it up for questions from anyone who cares to, on any subject. Yes? I don't know if they will act to override it. I fully expected the House to attempt an override. I don't know. I know that the House sponsor has requested his colleagues not try to override it, and so I'm not sure how the House will react in response to that request.
I know that you issued a statement sort of explaining your thought process in the process of deciding to veto. What would you say to lawmakers who are, again, taking up this issue today?
I would say, as I said in the veto message, that the legislation puts our school districts in the position of having to comply with a state law that then invites litigation from the federal government. And why do we want to put our school districts in that position? Currently, in those rare instances where you have a transgender student who has an issue with how they're going to manage the bathroom situation, school districts are working it out. They're finding a solution that satisfies the student and satisfies their student body, and we don't have to go to court to figure that out. Let those decisions remain local where they're best made. Yes?
So you were saying that you're
Well, I've never had a situation where I vetoed a bill that the House of Origin doesn't move to override. I mean, it's a natural part of the process that if the governor vetoes, then the next step is the House of Origin considers a vote to override or not. Now, how they will act in response to a prime sponsor saying, let's not do that, I can't say. We'll see.
If they decide to reconsider, can you remind me of the process? If they do override the veto today, does it go to the Senate directly today, or will we see more action next week?
I think the message to the House was just read yesterday, so it could possibly come up today. I doubt that they will want to, on this last day of the week of session, traditionally the legislature has an abbreviated calendar. So I would expect that if they choose to debate and vote upon an override decision, I'm guessing it would be more like Monday. If they are successful, then they will send that message to the Senate. It will be read, and the Senate can put it on their calendar at any time thereafter. In the final days, they typically put it on the calendar the same day. But if that happened on Monday, I expect they wouldn't. They'd probably put it on the calendar for Tuesday or Wednesday. There's no great rush, I don't think, on their part, because they've got other bills that have hard deadlines that this does not.
Another big topic this week was your decision to wait on Medicaid expansion discussion. I'm wondering if you have any more information about the coalition's work moving forward, and if you know recently an IHS hospital in Rosebud got news that they might be losing their funding through CMS. Just wondering if that plays into this conversation at all.
I don't have any more information today than I had when I announced that we are going to stand down from urging a vote this session. We continue to look at our policies. We're going to start having conversations with non-IHS providers to understand their willingness and interest in entering into these agreements with IHS service units, and in their ability to interact with IHS service units using electronic health record exchange, the health information exchange, I believe it's called. And so we're having conversations, and I know the Secretary of Health has some scheduled meetings already toward that end. The concern or the question about the Rosebud emergency room facilities and the shuttering of that is of great concern. Just to give you some understanding of the timeline, CMS, as a federal agency, undertakes reviews of federal facilities to determine their compliance with CMS regulations. And so, conversely, the state undertakes investigations of state and nonprofit facilities in South Dakota for that same purpose. So we ourselves will go into nursing homes, hospitals, and measure their compliance with regs to be sure that they are compliant with CMS regulations. Again, and on the federal side of things, if it's a federal unit like IHS units are, it's the federal government does that. They did that unannounced in November of last year. And when they found problems, they gave them the official notice, which is a 90-day notice. And that notice was to expire February 17, I believe. February 17. They came in, and they, essentially the notice says it was sent and it was published that as of February, I think it was 17, you must come into compliance or your funding ends for not only Medicare, but also Medicaid as well. And then when they came back in February to see how are you doing, the service unit, the Rosebud Hospital, asked, could we have a 30-day extension? So that extension was given, and in accordance with the law and the regs, a notice was issued again and a publication was made again that moved the date from February 17, 30 days later, March 16, since there's 29 days. I think those are the right dates. And so we are very concerned. We've been having conference calls with health facilities in the surrounding area, with ambulance, emergency medical service providers in the area. We're trying to collect data. There's some anecdotes about people, you know, having to be transported longer distances to Valentine or Winter, and are they having poor outcomes as a consequence of the longer transportation. We're trying to determine whether the anecdotes that is occurring, whether those anecdotes are in fact true, and whether the data supports that. We don't have control over the IHS facility, and as a federal organization being investigated by another federal organization, certainly it's within the federal government's realm to try and correct this in a way that gets that emergency service back up and running and keeps them qualified as an institution for Medicare and Medicaid payments. We want that to occur. We certainly are willing to help in any way that we can. And it just, in my mind, creates more urgency for better health care services by all means, Medicaid expansion included, for Native Americans who are served by these organizations that can't seem to serve them well.
Are there any questions on the phone line? Tess?
Yes, Governor.
Yes, stand by. There's someone in the room. Is your mic on?
There we go. Do you want me to start over?
Yeah, go. Start over for those on the call.
Got it. Okay. So with regards to the transportation network company bill, which would allow ride-sharing services like Uber to come into our state and outlines insurance coverage for the TNC driver and the TNC transportation network company. You know, this has been a big talker, especially among young people in our state. Is this something that you would like to see in South Dakota?
Well, philosophically, I like the idea of shared services like that. I confess I haven't heard all the pros and cons. I'm sure those who run taxi services are concerned about it, worried about their livelihood, worried about are those kinds of services as high quality and providing the kind of protections to the riders that we do. I'm sure those arguments can cut both ways. So I confess I have not educated myself on that bill very well, and so I guess I'd reserve comment until I have.
Just wanted to let you know that in the Senate committee that just passed in that, and in the House committee it passed the House and Energy, there actually wasn't anyone that opposed it. There was no taxi cab companies that came and opposed it. So do you think that would be telling of how this people think of
it? It usually is. It's not always indicative. There are sometimes that those who are affected and would oppose it are just uninformed, maybe aren't as engaged as they maybe would be or should be in having an awareness of what's occurring at the legislative level. They might be more focused on the municipal level. But oftentimes, the lack of opposition certainly is helpful to the proponents.
There is a
Governor
question.
Governor Dugard, can I ask you again about the your veto, kind of what helped you make your decision and why you decided to veto it? I know you talked with some transgender students, but what kind of solidified your decision?
Well, I did read some of the court cases, and I do believe that the Obama administration has probably stretched the interpretation of Title IX. Title IX clearly talks about sex, not gender. So the policy that tries to shoehorn in gender regulation under the statute, which clearly talks about sex and not gender, is a bit of a reach. However, I may disagree with that. It doesn't justify, in my mind, placing our school districts into the position of having to fight that legal battle unnecessarily. So after I understood better the federal situation and how local school districts can adjust without really generating the potential for a legal battle, well, let's let them adjust. Let's let them deal with these situations without regard to whether the policy is in court with them or not. These things are rare, and that they're not widespread across South Dakota. To the extent that they occur, then let the school districts deal with them on a case-by-case basis. They seem to be doing that just fine right now.
Going back to Medicaid expansion, you had mentioned you would support a special session. Can you give me some more specifics on that? Is it likely that that will happen? And when might we see that happen?
The likelihood of it happening is dependent upon us concluding that we can indeed achieve the savings we need to achieve to offset the cost of expansion. So we were, even as late as last Friday, still uncertain about a couple of policy decisions, because CMS had said one thing and then later they said something the opposite, and then later they went back again, so we weren't sure where they were going to land on one of their policies. And so the letter landed, and so now, knowing where they are on some of these policy decisions, now we can judge how much money we can save or not save in all the various fact patterns. So where we have people on the reservation that start their care at an IHS facility, or if they're off the reservation and start their care at a non-IHS facility, those are the extremes. In one case, very clearly the policy will allow 100% FMAP recovery. In the other case, the policy very clearly will not. And then there are others. There's long-term care situations where a Native American is referred by their doctor to a nursing home. You know, that now clearly is something that can be 100% FMAP if the IHS eligible person is referred by their doctor there. If they go straight to a non-IHS long-term care facility, again, it's like the other extreme, no 100% FMAP. So we have to figure out how many of those people will make those choices, which are within their right as individuals to choose who's their provider and how they get to a provider, whether it's through point A to point B or go straight to point B. We have to make some judgments about what's likely to be the behaviors of each of these individuals in these health situations and in these geographies. And one of the calculations will depend upon whether or not we can get a demonstration project going or not. Because in Sioux Falls, for example, there is no nearby IHS facility, and yet we have a fairly large population of Native Americans who are Medicaid eligible and who would become, and others who would become Medicaid eligible under expansion. So we have to look at all those situations, calculate the likelihood of recovering 100% FMAP, and then talk to those providers to see if they'd be willing to jump through the hoops that even if the individual was willing to follow the trail that leads to 100% FMAP, is the provider, the point B provider, also willing to enter into the contract and have a health information exchange established and allow the IHS referring doctor to maintain control over the health record and continue to counsel the individual being referred. All those things have to fall into place. And so will we have a special session? It depends on whether the numbers add up. When? It depends upon when we can figure that out.
We're hearing some noise from the phone lines, so if you're on the phone, please make sure your lines are muted. Star 6. Go ahead, Dana.
Governor, have you seen the bill that would allow insurance companies to give scholarships to private and parochial schools, and in turn they would get a tax credit from
yes.
the state?
Yes, I've seen a draft of it. I guess I can't recall whether I've looked at it in the form it was introduced, and I'm not sure if it's been amended or not, to tell you the truth. I'm aware it's out there.
I was just going to ask what your thoughts were on a bill like that in a year when the state is really looking to expand funding for public education.
Well, I visited with the sponsors of the bill, and my concern expressed to them was it needs to be budget neutral. And I'd consider it if it were budget neutral. It doesn't mean I'll sign it, but I will not sign it if it's not budget neutral. So I think they are earnestly and honestly attempting to make it budget neutral. And then I need to look at the philosophy behind it.
Anything else? All right, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks everyone.